The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This is the first class on Shabbat. There are a number of difficulties that we have with regards to Shabbat. We have to figure out what Shabbat is. We have to figure out why Shabbat is. By way of introduction, and there's a reason, by the way, that I don't even try to cover this topic in one class, and we do it rather in two, because as you'll see, there'll be issues that will arise today that essentially, we're going to get to that, okay? So be aware of that. Now here's an interesting question. If I could think of one word that the average person thinks of when they think of Shabbat, there's one word that comes to mind back when we're sort of first coming into contact with the concept of Shabbat and whether we're interested in it. And most of us, not all of us, but most of us at one point when we were 15 or 14 or 17 or 13 or whatever it might be, we sort of were aware that there was a Shabbat concept and that we could be doing more traditionally with regards to that Shabbat. And there was something that prevented us from doing that, from embracing the idea. I mean, is that a fair assumption? You know, everybody here at some point sort of knew that they could go to the synagogue and do the synagogue thing. Or they knew that they could kind of decide not to do this, that, or the other. And there was something that seemed to be an obstacle, an impediment. It seemed to say, you know what, this deal just is not for me. Do you know what that one word is? One word. Don't. Right? Right? Don't. Because now see, asking you this question now, of course, is ridiculous. Because you just saw that a Shabbat is not about don't. So, that's why I didn't go around the room and see who would say that. But I'm willing to bet that 5 years ago, that would be the word that comes to mind. And you know what? It's true. When people think of Shabbat, they think of a list of don'ts. Don't do this, and don't do that. Right? Just off the top of your heads, how many don'ts can we come up with? All right? Let's see. All right? Don't what? No. I want specifics. Don't what? Have you ever made a decision in your life not to thresh? Okay. Not to plow? I mean, when you sit down at a big meal, you may not plow. But other than that, so I want the real ones, right? Not the pardon? Don't rip toilet paper. That's a good one. That's, by the way, a good one. I remember once I was sitting in a class, and I was in, at this point, I was already studying to be a rabbi, and I wasn't having dilemmas about my concept of Shabbat, and I'm sitting in this class on halakha, and as we're sitting in this class, I'm thinking to myself, you know what? Because I told you, I used to run, I used to run programs in the Jewish agency with people from really left field, very, very little background. Maybe I'll get a chance to tell you about it. Well, I was sitting in this class in halakha, thinking like, if one of those kids was sitting in this class, they would have thought that I was nuts. I'll give you an example. Ripping toilet paper on Shabbat. Random example, right? So what do you do? Well, you don't rip toilet paper on Shabbat. Okay. You don't want to destroy, for whatever the reason. We'll have to figure out what it is. Okay. So you don't rip toilet paper on Shabbat. Now, if I tell you that you don't write on Shabbat, okay, so that's really easy. So you don't write. I mean, it may not be easy, but if you've decided not to write, so you decided not to write. And even if somebody comes along and says to you, listen, this is the winning lottery number, write it down. So, if you really decided you can't write, you'll figure out a way to remember it. You'll get 9 people, and you'll stand them all on a line, and you'll give each one 1 number, and at the end of Shabbos, you'll come back to them, they'll read it off, and you'll know it. You'll find some system. For $4 million, you'll find some system. But if you're sitting in the bathroom, and there's no toilet paper, because you can't rip it, so what are you going to do? I mean, you got to do what you got to do. So we were having this discussion, and we were talking about this particular category of malacha, of labor. We'll get to that too, right? You're not allowed to rip, however we got to it. And this question came up. And they were having a discussion, and I want to point out to you what seems absurd, so that by the end of our two classes, you will realize the beauty in this discussion. Okay? So, we're sitting there discussing this, and say, okay, what if you do? What do you do if there is no toilet paper? Okay, so you got to rip before Shabbat, and you put tissues. I'm not into this. I don't know if you have this problem, but you know, like some people, they take a whole roll of toilet paper, and they rip it kind of down the middle, and then they end up with a whole thing of toilet paper. Then you're sitting there, and you got to like separate. It's very annoying. So I'm a big believer in Kleenex boxes. I figure at the end of my life, if I count all the money I spent on extra Kleenex boxes, it's not going to put me in the poorhouse. But everybody has the system, fine. But you didn't do it. So you have no ripped toilet paper. So what do you do? So there are different opinions. So one opinion is, well, what you do is, you take the roll, and you use the toilet paper, but you don't rip it. And then at the end, you just flush it. And the flushing will rip it on its own. So you didn't rip it, the toilet ripped it. Ah! And I'm thinking, imagine if somebody was sitting in this class on halacha, and they walked into a yeshiva, and they're thinking, oh, I want to discover the beauty of Judaism, and I want to discover the beauty of Shabbat. And somebody says, oh, there's a class on the halachot of Shabbat. And they come in, and they sit down, and they're so excited, the majesty of the Sabbath, and the angels, and the queen, and everything, and just let the toilet rip the paper. So what is that? And there's so many don'ts. Don't rip toilet paper. Don't turn on the lights. Don't write. Don't ride. Don't do this. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. I mean, what is Shabbat? Shabbat is a day of
rest.
Oh, day of rest. So I got a great idea. The new Benny Friedman Shabbat. So you met my family. So, you know, I never get enough time with my family, so I got a great idea. This Shabbat, I'm not with the Israelite, right? Physically. So I'll get my family together, Shabbat morning early, and we'll get in the car, and we'll drive to the beach. And the whole way there, we'll sing Shlomo Kalbach songs. And then when we get to the beach, we'll sit on the beach, and you know what? We'll rest. It'll be amazing. And we'll have quality family time. It'll be wonderful. And we'll bring some wine, we'll have a little Kiddush action, you know. The day will just fly by. And it'll be magnificent. And I'll lie back and I'll look at the clouds and I'll hear the sounds of the waves. I see half of you won't be here tomorrow. You'll be over the beach, right? But, I mean, so that will be Shabbat. And I want you to know, it's very important. Somebody who decides that that's their Shabbat, it's for me to say that there's anything wrong with it, that's wonderful. God should grant that every family in Israel would get together and drive to the beach and experience Shabbat together as a family on the beach after driving. This should be our biggest problem. So what's the big deal? Why can't I do that? Why do I choose not to do that? And I remind you again, this is not about why anyone shouldn't do it, but I'm sharing with you my perception of Shabbat. You have to put it in a box, analyze it, decide whether it's for you, not what you gain from it, and then find out somebody else's perception of Shabbat, and put that in a box, and mix it all up, and you'll come out with your perception of Shabbat. Okay. So how do I understand Shabbat? And where does Shabbat come from? So, let's take a look now at the text of the commandment. Okay? Because the questions here are very difficult. I mean, when I look at the questions of Shabbat, okay, they are really the greatest impediment to my discovering a relationship with Shabbat. And so we have to figure that out. So let's look at this. Perek Chaf, the 20th chapter of Exodus, verse 8. Okay? Zachor et yom ha-Shabbat lekadsho. Remember the Sabbath day, l'kadsho, to sanctify it. Here it says to keep it holy. Not so simple, but okay. Right? So what does that mean? So I got a great idea. Again, I'll come into Israelite, and I'll knock on the dorm. First on the men's dorm, then I'll go to the women's dorm. Maybe Shpinzi will go to the women's dorm, right? And we'll bang on the door, and we'll say, just want everybody to remember it's Shabbos today. Have a nice day. And that's it. Zachor et yom ha-Shabbat. Remember Shabbat. Except that there's this little word, right? Lekadsho. To sanctify it. So we got to figure out what that means. Okay. So now I've got this idea I'm supposed to remember Shabbat. Just out of curiosity. Anything bother you about that? Pardon? Yeah, well, okay. It is Shabbat. Why would you forget it? Of course, that needs further thought because go take a walk out in the streets and you see how many people forget it. But okay. But essentially what you're telling me is, why is this the word? Right? So I would expect, celebrate Shabbat. Experience Shabbat. Right? Discover Shabbat. love Shabbat. What is remember Shabbat? Okay. Now look what happens. Sheshet yamim ta'avod. 6 days you should work. V'yasita kol melachtecha. Not do some work. Do all your work. Right? Okay. I'll read it again. Sheshet yamim ta'avod. 6 days you shall work. V'yasita kol melachtecha. You should do all your work. Two different words. Sheish tamim ta'avod. 6 days you work. And do all your melacha. So I just translated melacha as work. But I translated ta'avod as work. They're not the same word, right? So what's the difference? Okay. Uvayom ha-shivyi, Shabbat la'Hashem Elokecha. And on the seventh day is for God. You're God. Lo ta'aseh kol melacha, and you shouldn't do any labor, any melacha. So now what is the essence of Shabbat? Now this is very important. What's the essence of Shabbat? You shouldn't do what? Any work, any melacha. And that makes sense, right? In fact, there are 39 categories of labor. Right? That are traditionally passed down. How they're passed down is another question. So for example, anybody ever work in a kibbutz? Anything like that? Ever work in a kibbutz? Okay. Did you ever work out in the fields on the kibbutz? Okay. So I can definitely handle the concept that on Shabbat, I don't want to work in the fields. Right? I worked out, I remember we used to get up like 4 in the morning. I was on kibbutz Ein Sirim. And I spent 3 months discovering that I was not meant to live in a kibbutz. Thank God for capitalism. Yes, thank you very much. Right? And these individuals who I have infinite respect for, they built the country, but who for the life of me I cannot fathom, wake up at 4 in the morning, and they go out to the fields to pick cotton. And they're out there till 7, and then they come back and they pray. Then they go back again at 8. By 11, 12 o'clock, they can't be out there anymore, it's too hot. And then they go back out again later in the afternoon in the field until dusk. And it's hard work, so I can understand that. So Shabbat is a day of rest. Okay, whatever that means. And it's a day of rest la'Hashem. I guess I'm supposed to be thinking about God. So I shouldn't be working. I shouldn't be dealing with the mundane. Fine. So plowing a field, that's work. Sowing the seeds, that's work. Threshing and winnowing and reaping, that's work. But when you start to think about it, that doesn't make sense. Because when I start to think about the things that traditionally, a traditional Jew doesn't do on Shabbat, whatever that means, doesn't do on Shabbat, so it doesn't really fit. I'll give you an example. I wake up one morning, and I decide that, enough is enough. I've been in Israelite too long, the Israelite lunches is too good, the Israelite Shabbat Torah too good, so I'm going to do some exercises, right? So I get up in the morning, I do a little breathing first, and I start the exercise, right? I mean, that's just not work. As a matter of fact, I'll go a stage further. Let's say you come in here, and we decide, right? I mean, turning on a light switch off and on, it's just not work. You come in here one night, you decide, okay, we're going to have an oneg. You'll see, B'ezrat Hashem, we're going to be in Efrat for Shabbat. We'll have an oneg Shabbat after dinner, right? So well, you know, the mechitzot are still set up, and the chairs are still around. So, you know, I have Rachmanis on Sprinzi and Jean, so I get a few students, whatever, and we get together, we decide we're going to set up the tables, and we're going to move the mechitzot, and we're going to move the chairs, and we're going to set it up. And I get here, and none of the students come. Why? Because they're in a shiur, they're learning Torah, and they can't pull themselves away. Okay, so that's wonderful. So I decide I'll do it on my own, so I set up all the tables, and I move all the chairs, whatever. And then I realize, you know what? There's no heating on. It's cold. So I say, okay, you know what? We should really do this over there. But I don't want to leave the table set up. So I unset up the tables, and I put the chairs back, and I put the machitza. Everything is back. And then I go over to the dining room, and I realize that the dining room was set up still for dinner. So I redo all the tables there, and I do all the chairs there, and I do all the things. By the time I'm finished, I'm sweating, whatever. Any problem with this on Shabbat? Biblically speaking, no problem. As a matter of fact, even rabbinically speaking, no problem. Ideally, you're not supposed to do things which make you sweat, you know, rabbinically. But really, for an oneg Shabbat, you could do this. No problem. Makes you sweat, no problem. Now, Shabbat morning, I find this great Dvar Torah. Unbelievable Dvar Torah. Somebody hands me one of these little, you know, they have these handouts in synagogue. You know, it's great. Right? Little magazine reading, Torah reading, it's good stuff. And somebody gives me one of these, and I want to show it to somebody. So I want to walk outside in a public domain, outside of an Eruv, we'll get to what that is, so don't worry if you don't know, whatever. But I want to walk outside, but I'm carrying it. Am I allowed to carry it on Shabbat? Can't do it. Traditionally, one of the 39 categories of labor. So I can move all these desks inside here, but I can't carry a feather outside. So how does that work? So obviously, our idea of labor as being hard work doesn't work. So what is labor? What am I not supposed to be doing? And by the way, just as an aside, it stands to reason that everyone, and this is to me the biggest challenge, it never ceases to amaze me. And I've told you before, I think that one of the most important things we have in our lives is the freedom of choice. To make choice. To become aware of an idea, to analyze it, to perceive it, and to decide, based on our own faculties, whether it makes sense to us. I don't know, evolution. So evolution, to a certain extent, is a perception that's shared by many brilliant individuals. So you can't look at something like evolution and just discount it without studying it. But if you study Darwinism and Neo-Darwinism, etc., and you balance it against your perspective, whatever it is, and you come to a logical conclusion that to you there are problems with it, so that's legitimate. If you discount it without ever understanding it, that's ridiculous. Right? So I have my problems with evolutionary theory, certainly Darwinistic evolutionary theory. They have nothing to do with whether or not it contradicts the Bible, because I don't think Darwinism, I don't think evolution in general contradicts the Bible. And that's just as an aside, right? I mean, I don't know, man is created on the sixth day. What's created on the fifth day? Anybody know? Animals. Before animals, the lower forms of life, the fish. Before that, the water. I already know, as I mentioned to you once, that a day in the 6 days of creation is not a 24-hour period, because the sun isn't created until the fourth day. So the first 3 days are not days as we know them. So I have to at least assume logically that those 6 days, being as how they're all mentioned as being equal periods, are six periods of time, and I don't know what they are. So the evolutionary process of man after animal and lower forms of life such as lizards before animals in different periods of time fits with the Bible. My problem with evolution has nothing to do with that. My problem with evolution is scientific. It's just never been proven. There's none of the scientific findings that should have corroborated it have ever been found. So that's a scientific issue. But I can't discount evolution without at least considering it. And yet people do the same thing all the time with spiritual ideas. And by the way, not just with Judaism. You know, you mentioned to somebody the concept of, a psychic healer. And the average person gets a smile on their face. Now, if you'd ever met a psychic healer, you would do anything but smile. You'd be in awe. Because there's something there. You can't discount it. I'll tell you a true story. Rabbi Aaron told me, we were talking on Shabbos. He said that there was a woman who came here. She was a student here. One of these days I'm going to get to meet her. And she's a psychic healer. And, you know, she came, whatever, they developed a relationship. She learned an Israelite, etc. And her man maintained a certain relationship. She's always trying to help and to give advice, whatever. So she once worked on Rabbi Aaron. And there's no problem, you know. She doesn't, she actually worked on their child. I forget which one it was. One of their children, right after it was born, had all sorts of, it was a cesarean birth. So she walked in, she came to them for a meal on Shabbat, and she took a look at the baby, and she said, wow, there's so much distress there, so much energy out of place, the spine and this, I want to work on it. So they were, you know, the Aaron's looking to like, a psychic healer working on a child. She said, don't worry, I won't do anything. So she puts her hands around the baby. This is Rabbi Aaron describing this to me, and he said he got really scared, because you can see sparks. It's like, it's real like energy. It's like there's something going on, like you know when you rub your sweater and you get those sparks? That was the sound that was coming out of her fingertips. Rabbi Aaron said, like, whoa, right? Like, his hair used to be straight until I said, no. So anyway, once he told her that he was going to the States and they were going on a fundraising trip, whatever. So she said, the man in the red shirt. That's the answer. So Aaron's like, okay, listen, listen to me. The man in the red shirt is the answer. Okay, so he and whoever it was, someone from the board, they were trying to figure out who's the person in the red shirt, what does that mean, who could it be, whatever. So everywhere he went, you know, they were kind of looking at it. But whatever, they kind of forgot about it. And they were sitting Friday night, they were in somebody's house out in L.A. And it was someone, obviously, with a lot of money, and they were, you know, approaching them and talking to them, whatever, and somebody wanted to support his life. And in the middle of the meal, this person spilled wine on themselves and excused themselves to go change and came back with a red shirt. So Rabbi Aaron and this other guy was sitting there, didn't like, whoa, right? I don't know if he gave any money in the end, but yeah, it's a good story. But, you know, you have to appreciate the things we don't understand. And yet with Shabbat, here we do the same thing. If it stands to reason that our perception of melacha, of labor, is at the root of what Shabbat is about, and if we don't know what melacha is, then we can't possibly understand what Shabbat is about. I mean, it's just logical. If the Torah tells me that the whole essence of Shabbat is that 6 days I do melacha, whatever it is, And on the seventh day, I don't. I devote it to God. So if I don't know what melacha is and what it means, well, then I can't figure out what Shabbat is. So I can't have a perception of Shabbat. So let's take a look at what melacha is. What is it that you think, based on your knowledge of things that traditionally we do and don't do in Shabbat? What do you think melacha is? Just out of curiosity.
Things that create or destroy.
Things that create?
Like acts of creation.
Oh, very good. In other words, you're saying, don't be creative on Shabbat. Now I want you to know, this is a great idea. Not only is it a great idea, but I could give you a whole class on it. Except that there's one problem with it. Right? In other words, that I shouldn't be creative. God is the creator. Okay, great. Right? We could do a whole lecture series, except there's one problem with it. There are two things that I can think of that are the most creative acts that a human being can do in this world, physically and spiritually, which are not only allowed on Shabbat, but they're even desirable on Shabbat. What are they? Sex, relationships, and Torah. Right? There is no more creative act in the physical world between human beings than physical relationship. And of course, I'm supposed to learn Torah on Shabbat. And Torah is a tremendously creative spiritual act. So it can't be that I'm not allowed to do creativity. So what is it I'm not allowed to do? That's a problem. And we have to figure that out. What's going on? What is Shabbat about? What is it I'm supposed to do? And what is it I'm not supposed to do? Okay. So now, there are two ways that this could go. I could ask you a whole bunch of more questions, and we could finish this class today, and we could sort of have all the questions down, and then tomorrow I could give you, but I won't do that to you, because that's really mean. So, let me give you a perception. This is such an incredible idea. But I want you to realize, based on the discussion that we had, the first class, which is that there are different ways of analyzing a mitzvah. There is the ethical perspective, the symbolic perspective, the mystical perspective. I want to try to understand this. Now, I told you when it comes to the mystical perspective, we just don't have the time in these classes to get into them. So maybe we'll get a taste of it, maybe we won't, but I want you to know there's a whole level to Shabbat. I mean, when I was in Gush, so I gave a class on Shabbat, on the meaning of Hilchot Shabbat. Now, somebody was giving a class on Hilchot Shabbat, on the laws of Shabbat, and it became apparent to me that these guys were learning all the what's, but they weren't understanding the whatabouts. So I talked to this guy, a brilliant Torah scholar who was giving the halachot, and I said, let's do a class together. You give a class on the halachot, you'll let me know what you're teaching, and I'll give a class on the meaning of the halachot, and what it means, and how this fits in within the organic picture of Shabbat as a whole. Right? So I did this for a whole year. So you can imagine that trying to fit Shabbat into 2 hours is going to be difficult. Okay? Just so you understand as a frame of reference. However, Rav Shimshon Feil-Hirsch has a tremendous idea. He says this in a number of places. I believe he talks about it in Charev. Rav Shimshon Feil-Hirsch, by the way, was a rabbi who lived in the 19th century in Germany. And he was really one of the first Orthodox rabbis, whatever orthodoxy means, who, although he was a vehement battler against some of the perceptions that were coming from the Reform movement, nonetheless believed, if I'm accurately perceiving it, that there was much to be gleaned from the secular world, the world of science, etc. As a matter of fact, in his schools, he encouraged the boys to learn things like German, science, etc., as tools to understanding God's world. So Rav Shimshon Feil-Hirsch says a tremendous thing. And he writes a book called Chorev. Chorev is the other name for Sinai. And it's all about these kinds of questions. And you can actually get it in these little, you ever see these little Feldheim books that they sell? It's a really valuable thing to go into a Jewish bookstore with a lot of English books and just look at what the books are. Just see, you'll get excited. It's great. You know, you may find one and say, oh, you know what, this is fascinating. I'd love to buy this. I've learned a very valuable rule. When there's a library and it's free, nobody takes it. I'm willing to bet if I went around this room and got a percentage of how many books have been taken out by how many students since you got it a week ago, the percentage would be very low. When you buy a book and you've paid for it, well, then maybe you end up learning it because you paid for it. You want to get something out of it, right? So that's a valuable thing to do. Anyway, Rav Shimshon Feil-Hirsch writes in Chorev an unbelievable thing. He says, the problem that we call melacha is not creativity. It's productivity. What do I mean by productivity? If I take an item and I effect a change in that item, I produce something, then I'm essentially demonstrating that I have some measure of control in this world. In other words, if I take, for example, a field, And when you walk into a field, if you take some seeds and you throw them out in the field, nothing's going to happen. I mean, I don't know, you know, you may get lucky and one of them may sprout. But if you want to plant corn and you take corn seed and you throw it out in the field, nothing's going to happen because it's not going to take root. What do you have to do? You have to take a hoe and you have to plow furrows in the field. And by plowing the furrows, then the field is now ready to be planted. So if I plow a furrow in a field, I've effected a change in the physical world. I've made something of that field. I've made that field ready to receive seed. I've become a partner in the creation of life. Powerful idea. If I take dough, are you guys, by the way, hot?
Yes.
You are? Would you like the heater off?
Yes.
Is anybody here who wants the heater on?
Yeah.
Is there?
It'd be
okay, okay. Well, you got the, okay. Yeah, I get this, sometimes I get this, it's a finely honed instinct. It took me years to develop. You know, I can sense when my students are too warm in class. It's something like the expression that you get when they look like this. Right? So, I just clued into that. Anyway, alright. So, there are lots of different ways, by the way, to wake yourself up in class. This is one of them. But anyway, okay, you'll think about that. Anyway, right? Try it when you drive. Anyway, so, you with me here? Yes? You've woken up? Okay. Let's go. Alright. If I take a field, and if I take dough, and I knead it, and I put it in an oven, and I bake it, so I've taken that thing and I've made something of it. I've made bread. I've effected a change in the object. Now when I study Torah, that's not true. Because Torah can affect me, but I can't affect it. As a matter of fact, one of the biggest problems we have is that people think they can affect Torah. So they try to change the Torah around to fit their perception of what the world should be. But if Torah is really divine, and this begins from the same perception that I spoke about earlier, but if Torah is really divine, if it's from God, you can't change it. It can change you. That's the problem on Shabbat. I don't want to be productive. Now that becomes very interesting. The rabbis have a very interesting discussion. They say, think about it. Sheshet yamim ta'avod ve'asita kol melachtecha. 6 days, you should do it all. So what does that mean? Does that mean that for 6 days I'm allowed to do malacha, to be productive? Or does it mean that I have a mitzvah to be productive for 6 days? Now forget for a moment whether the commentaries will actually list this as one of the 613 mitzvot. Tradition places a very powerful emphasis on this verse. God creates a world. And he puts us here for a reason. And he wants us, or she wants us, to be partners in that world. 6 days, I've given you a world. What are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? What are you going to make of it? If you go into the world and leave it at the end the same way you came in, then what were you here for? What have you done? If you look at the end of your day and you feel, I've accomplished nothing, you want to know what the root of depression is? Viktor Frankl writes a very powerful book, Man's Search for Meaning. I mean, this is one of the deepest questions that have, you know, any philosopher, I mean, Sartre goes on and Bertrand Russell goes on, all the philosophers, atheists and otherwise, will discuss this. You know, what's my purpose here in this world? What makes me human? What separates me from animals? It's all one question. Can I find meaning? And if I have no meaning, that's the root of depression. If I don't feel I'm accomplishing anything. So comes the Torah and says, 6 days you have to accomplish. What are you going to accomplish? What are you going to do with it? And it's a gift to take the world that God gives us, which is imperfect, and to make ourselves partners in creation. And by the way, it's very interesting. God, at the beginning of creation, I mentioned to you, has a number of sayings, right? He says, you know, there should be light. And he says, the water should split. And he says, you know, let there be, you know, luminaries in the sky, and the sun and the moon, whatever. There's one of those sayings that's very, very difficult. Vayomer Elokim na'aseh Adam. Let us make man. Now that's a sentence that doesn't make sense. What do you mean, let us make man? Who's God talking to when God says, let us make man? I mean, it's God. And it was very specific. Na'aseh, let us make man. So there are different answers, talking to the angels, talking to the world, talking to creation. Soloveitchik has a magnificent answer. or a response. He says, God is talking to man. He's saying, I can create man, but I say to make man that we have to do together. And you are a partner in your own creation every day. You wake up in the morning and you say, who am I going to be? What am I going to make of myself? And you participate in the sixth day of creation every day of your life. Let us make man. And you build the world. And you make the world a better place. And you change the world. And you improve on the world. But you see, there's a danger in that. What's the danger in that?
Forget the garden.
Oh. You forget who put you there to make it to begin with. Because it's not accidental that as man delved and explored and entered the age of man, the enlightenment, the emancipation of man, the industrial revolution, as man gained power and became more in control of his world. And by the way, the Torah says that's what man should do. Hu yimshol bam. Man is supposed to rule the rest of creation. He's supposed to harness it. He's supposed to put it into proper perspective. He's supposed to do something good with it, whatever that means. But as we became more powerful, as we likened ourselves unto God, we began to forget who God is. I'll give you a powerful example. So God creates Adam. 10 generations later, it's all a mess. And then God creates Noah. So God brings a flood. So Noah is around, saves him from the flood, etc. And then comes Abraham, right? And Abraham, that's a whole different perception. Noah was going to be the father of all of humankind. Abraham is a point at which you realize it's not going to work, all of humankind together. Let's take one individual and see if he can be an ethical example. And we mentioned this. Now there's one story that comes in between the end of Noah and the beginning of Abraham. Does anybody know what it is? Very good. Tower of Babel. What's the Tower of Babel? I mean, I can think of lots of towers on Wall Street that are Towers of Babel. What's the Tower of Babel? What is that? So what happens? Nimrod, very good. Oh, you guys are up on this, okay? So they build this tower, and they're trying to reach up to the heavens. So I would think, what a great thing. They want to discover God. And I think, you know, magnificent. What could be wrong in that? And God looks at what they're doing and doesn't like it. What does it mean? They're so busy with building the monument that they forget who they're building it for. Originally, they wanted to show that they could reach the heavens. When the tower got high enough, they thought they were in the heavens. And if you're in the heavens, then you're God. And so it became the ultimate example of idol worship. And sometimes a mass of humanity together can be a very dangerous thing. Unity can be very powerful. It can be productive or it can be negative. Go to Germany in 1938 and you'll see how negative unity can be. You know, you ever see the pictures of hundreds of thousands of people with just these looks of raw, unadulterated enthusiasm. Blank looks almost in their eyes. Throwing out their hands in complete adulation. And you get an inkling of what the Tower of Babel could have been like. So as I build, and as I do it all, I forget that I'm not a doer, I'm a doee. I'm not just a creator, I'm a created. Do I remember that I'm not really in control? Do I remember that everything I do, the magnificent imprint that I can have on the world is for a purpose? And that it's not a world that I created, it's a world that was given to me to be a partner in creation. So comes along of Shimshon Falhersh, comes along the Torah and says, one day a week, don't be a producer. Zachor, remember. Get back to basics. Remember where it's all from. The Yom HaShivi'i, the seventh day, Shabbat LaHashem, Elokecha, to God. And by the way, and then I'll get to your question, by the way, this fits very well with the verses. Because if you look at what God says,
in verse 11, why are you keeping all of the Shabbat? Ki sheshet yamim asa Hashem et hashamayim v'et haaretz. Because God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days. God was the creator. And that's what you remember on Shabbat. Okay. Now you wanted to say something, Jesse.
What about
I want to tell you something. It's a very good question. What about relationships? Why aren't I producing? First of all, it's not so clear. But I will tell you, this is something that's very difficult to answer without giving the mystical perception. But I'll give you an idea. There's an incredible verse. Ki teitzei l'milchama, when you will go out to war. When a Jew went to war, there were different types of wars. There was a war that was called a melchemet mitzvah, a war of obligation. Alat tzarat tzareretchem, for example, when the enemy would come and attack. And Maimonides says that any conflict where the Jewish people is being threatened with destruction is actually not just a war, but a war of mitzvah. A Jew has an obligation to be willing to fight to save other Jewish lives. In other words, a Jew in the Warsaw Ghetto was fulfilling a mitzvah, of milchemet mitzvah, of a war of obligation. The wars in the state of Israel, in my opinion, are milchemet mitzvah. When I fought in a war, I was fulfilling a mitzvah from the Torah. Okay. But there's a different kind of war. And the other kind of war is milchemet reshut. It's a war which is not an obligation for everybody to go. It's a war which is done for certain reasons. I don't know, expansion. Treaty expansion. I have neighbors, they're blockading me. There are all sorts of different examples of what this would be like. It may well be that I'm not threatened, but God promised, let's say, a certain portion of the land, and we're conquering that portion of the land. In such a war, not everybody has to go. And the Bible tells me that there are certain individuals who don't have to go to such a war. Mi asher bana bait. If somebody built a house, v'lo chancho, and he didn't get to live in it. Mi asher natak karem. If somebody planted a vineyard and didn't get the taste of its fruit. Mi asher iras isha. And if somebody was betrothed to a woman and did not yet marry her, consecrate the relationship. So the rabbi, actually the Baruch Shamar, Rav Baruch Epstein, who's also known as the Torah Tamima, writes a very, very powerful idea. He says, these are different levels. When I build a house, I'm a creator. And I think that I'm in control. I'm a builder. I've done something. And there's a danger in being such a builder, because when you go to war, one of the most important ideas that you have to be aware of is that you're not really in control. You plant a vineyard. So you plant a field. And that's a different level. A person builds a house, so he takes the stone, and he takes the wood, and he takes everything, puts it together himself, and it's clear he's done all the work. A person plants a field, so it's true that he plows it, and he sows it, and he reaps it, he does everything. But at a certain point, you put the seed in the ground, and you're depending on God to make it grow. So you're a partner. So just because I think that I built a house doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to think that by having planted a field, planted a vineyard, that I still need not go to war. Because if the reason that I don't go to war for building a house and not having lived in it is because there's a danger of how building a house affects you, so I might think that that's not necessarily so when it comes to planting a vineyard. Even more so is this true with marriage. Because when it comes to marriage, I would really imagine that there's no reason for me not to go to war from this perception, from this idea. Because when you get married and you create life, you can't help but realize that you're only a partner in creation. And even so, you don't go to war. So why do I tell you that? Because I glean from that that even in the creative act of a partnership in the creation of life, it's a very different idea. Somehow, when a person gives birth, when a person is witness to the idea of birth, you sort of become aware that you're not in control. I remember the moment that my daughter was born. My first child. 1 minute there's 2 of you. And the next minute there's 3 of you. And it's unbelievable. It's just this, it's moment, it's incredible. And you just look, you're in awe. And you walk around with this stupid grin on your face. And so you can't imagine, you know, because you realize what a little piece of machinery you are in the system. The reason, by the way, that
that the physical act of developing a relationship with another human being has the potential to be so holy is because of our capability in giving it meaning that's beyond the physical essence of it. But you're right in that there's a certain danger. And that's why there's a certain type of physical relationship that's allowed on Shabbat. There's another type of physical relationship which at least traditionally is not allowed on Shabbat and not allowed during the week, right? And that may well be because of the dangers. I mean, we'll get to that when we talk about adultery. Okay. So this is a great idea, to remember who you are, to remember where you come from, to sort of get back in touch with it all, to realize that I shouldn't be making and doing and building and focusing on me, but to take a chance to step back. And this has tremendous value, because when I choose, you know, I said to you, for example, when we were talking about mitzvot, right? So I said to you, for example, when we were talking about mitzvot at the beginning, and we were talking about communications, and I was saying that sometimes you do something and you think, I've done nothing, and really you've made a whole speech. So if I walk into a room, and I make a choice, I choose not to turn on or off this light switch. So that's a whole communication. Because I'm essentially saying that the idea of light, and the energy of light, and taking a circuit and closing it, and producing or destroying energy, that's a tremendous power. One day a week I remember where that power really comes from. And that's what prevents me from forgetting. And it's very interesting, the concept of Shabbat comes every week. Some concepts within Judaism, it's enough to remember them once a year. Rosh Hashanah. You know, life and death. Yom Kippur. But there are some ideas I need every week, and Shabbat is one of them. Now this is all great. Except, I got a certain problem. Very interesting problem. You want to take a guess what my problem is? Interesting idea, no? Shabbat, right? Interesting idea. There's one little problem. And this problem for me serves to heighten the concept of Shabbat. And that's the question of carrying. Has anybody ever heard that one of the categories of labor on Shabbat is that you don't carry? You ever heard this? You may have heard this. Now, carrying is a very interesting malacha. It's a very interesting labor. And now that I use the word malacha, meaning labor, you understand what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a productive labor, right? The concept of carrying is very interesting. Because when I look at the technical aspect of carrying, it doesn't fit with what I just said. So I have to get a little technical here just for a minute and explain to you what I'm talking about. Because the actions that I do are my messengers. There's very much a relationship there. Maybe one day I'll give a class in Israelite on what I think angels are. That's a whole... But first we have to all float up in the air a little bit, you know? But that's a very... what angels are and what they're not and what they mean. So I've never met an angel, but from what little I know, very interesting. Anyway, so, whet your appetite a little. So carrying. So how does carrying work technically? So let's look at it from a biblical perspective, okay? I'm not going to get into the difference between the biblical and the rabbinical, but let's look at it from the biblical perspective. There are two ways of carrying biblically, okay? One is, if I take something from a private domain, right, what's called a reshut hayachid, the individual domain, and I carry it into a public domain. Now, I have to mention, by the way, just as an aside, I don't want anybody to assume from these classes in general, and especially from this one, that anything I'm saying can be taken to have halachic or legal implication. Because these details that I'm mentioning have such far, complex, ranging minutiae that you can't assume that you understand the halacha or how it works. Now, you should very much take these issues and reflect on them with regards to your relationship with Shabbat. But don't assume from something that I say that something is normally, at least traditionally, permissible or prohibited, because it may be that you walk away with the impression something shouldn't be done and really there's no problem with it, and vice versa. Because I don't have the time to get into all these details. If you're curious and you want to set some time, I'd be glad to. But you understand my point, okay? So, there are all sorts of other, you know, you might walk away thinking that anything but what I'm describing is okay, and that's not true. However, so if I take and you don't know what a public domain is and what a private domain is and how to define them, okay. But if I pick something up in a private domain, let's say this house, this is my private domain, and I walk out here into Central Park, right, and I put it down, okay? So now I have transgressed biblically the prohibition against carrying on Shabbat. Right? The other way, by the way, of carrying is if I pick something up in a public domain and I carry it a certain distance. In other words, I walk what's called four amot, four cubits. Right? cubit is about a foot and a half, 2 feet, whatever, it doesn't matter, whatever a cubit is, right? So if I walk 4 cubits in a public domain, I don't know, I'm walking down the street, and a student sees me, and they're playing football, and they go, hey, Bine, catch, right? And I run out, and I catch the ball, right? And I run with it, and I go, ah, he spikes it, right? So I have transgressed the biblical prohibition against carrying, by carrying 4 cubits in public domain. Okay, now, there's a problem with this. What's the problem with this? So let's say that this, okay, is my book. And let's say this table is my private domain. And this table is my public domain. Okay? Right? And I am giving a shiur, a class, on the Bible in my public domain. So I pick up this Bible, okay, which is right now exactly at the corner of this table, right? And I pick it up, and I put it down in my public domain. And then I say, oh, you know what? I don't really need this book. I really wanted another book. So I pick it up again, right? And I put it back in my private domain, right? So have I transgressed? Transgressed, right? How many times?
Twice. You didn't go 4 cubits.
No. 4 cubits is in a public domain. Now, if I'm in a walking in a public domain, then, you know, if I'm standing in a public domain and this is here, and I just pick it up like this, I haven't transgressed, right? But if I carry it, then I have a certain distance. So what's the definition of carrying? Carrying is 4 cubits. But from private to public, or public to private, just moving it between one and the other, even if it's 1 cubit, is enough to make it a problem, right? Okay. So I've transgressed twice. Here's my problem. What have I done to the object? I mean, if you happen to turn around, right? Here. You see that mechitza over there on the wall? Right? So, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. It's still there. It's exactly what it was before. It's the same object, same place. So why is this a problem? Why is carrying a problem? It doesn't make sense. And I'll go you one stage further. Because to me the real challenge, can I take one single halakha during these 3 weeks, which seems to be ridiculous, and actually make sense out of it? Actually give you a perspective that shows you that there may well be a beauty to it. If I can do that, then maybe you'll walk away saying to yourself, you know what? There are so many ridiculous, or seemingly ridiculous ideas in Judaism, these little minutiae, like toilets flushing the paper, right? That I say to myself, you know what, this whole thing is ridiculous. But maybe if I can show you just one little ridiculous sounding looking idea, and show you that there's a beauty to it, then maybe you'll say to yourself, okay, maybe every other ridiculous looking sounding idea might have some beauty to it. So the challenge would be, can I find it? Okay, so I'm going to do that. So this is really weird halacha. I mean, it doesn't get much weirder than this. This is a weird halacha. If I'm walking in a public domain, and I want to be able to carry, so I can do something which will turn it into a private domain. Now, if you want to be technically specific, I can't actually turn a public domain into a private domain. Okay? I can turn a rabbinic public domain into a private domain. But if something is a biblical public domain, then I can't do that. In other words, the rabbis came along and said, well, if biblically you're not allowed to carry in a public domain, there are all sorts of other domains or areas that look like a public domain. So we're going to tell everybody not to carry in those as well. Because it's too easy to get confused. I'll give you an example. One opinion of the definition of a public domain is a place that 600,000 people normally walk. Because that's how many people walk through the desert. So that was like public. So for example, the island of Manhattan might be a public domain. Right? But if I have a place which is very public, like this courtyard out here, but you don't get 600,000 people in there. So it's not really biblically a public domain. I mean, you might go in there on an evening to sit quietly with a friend and have a private discussion. Right? You wouldn't necessarily do it in the middle of Times Square. Right? So there's a difference. So Rabbi said, yeah, but you know what? If you start carrying in this kind of a public domain, you're going to carry in that kind of public domain. So this is called a rabbinic public domain. So Rabbi's come along and say, okay, and that's called a Carmelite, if you're curious. But, you know, you can almost forget everything I just told you if it doesn't bother you. Okay. What's important to me is that there is a biblical public domain and a rabbinic public domain. So Rabbi's come along and said, well, you know what, though? Sometimes it's difficult.
It's difficult not to carry in a public domain. I'll give you an example. Let's say you want to go to synagogue, right? You want to take your children. Are you allowed to carry your kid? So I'm not going to get into all the halakhic details. Is there a difference if a child's already walking because then the child's really carrying himself or not? Whatever, fine. I don't know, you want to take a prayer book with you. All sorts of reasons that you would want to carry. So the rabbi said, well, if you want to carry in a public domain, as long as it's not a biblical public domain, it's a rabbinic public domain, then all you have to do is you have to set up something called an eruv. Now what's an eruv? An eruv really means responsibility. It means that I share something, right? But essentially it means that I've made a sign. So I take a wire, and I put it around an area, and that wire is called an eruv, right? And I sort of take responsibility, me and my community, we agree that this area is really going to be a private domain. It's not a public domain. So if I walk inside a wire, right, it's a private domain. And you can't just put up a wire, you have to designate this wire as an eruv. So how do people designate it? Well, they have a ceremony, they put some bread aside, whatever they do, they put Coke cans on it. You ever walk on the edge of the city, sometimes you'll see there's a wire. When you go to Efrat for Shabbat, you'll see this. There's a wire around the city with Coke cans hung in it. That's how you know where the Eruv is. So that if you're walking under the Eruv, right? So I remember once, for example, I was doing work with this group. I used to call them Kiddush groups. They were groups that came out of the Jewish Agency. And it was a great idea. You know, people go on a tour. They come for the summers. They go on a tour of Masada, and they go on a tour of Jerusalem, and they go on a tour of Tel Aviv. Somebody said, let's give them a tour of Shabbat. So they called us Shabbat guides. It was a brilliant idea. And, you know, they got a certain amount of funding from the Jewish Agency, and they agreed to do these kinds of programs, and it was wonderful. And I remember my first group, and I was, not long out of the army, and I met this group. They were a group from England. I went around the group. I mean, you have to understand this group. There were six skinheads in the group. One of them had a swastika sort of, I don't know, it was like he took a knife and engraved it in the back of his head. So you're not talking about, ready for yeshiva group. And I went around this group, not a single kid in this whole group, they were teenagers, knew what Kiddush was. They had never heard what Kiddush was. None of them had ever seen candle lighting on Shabbat. So this may not be a big deal to some of you. To me at the time, it's like, wow, I can't believe 50 Jewish kids, and they've never experienced Shabbat, never seen Kiddush, don't know anything. So I'm talking to this group, and I'm spending Shabbat with them, and they really knew very little, and we had a wonderful, wonderful Shabbos, and I had a lot of fun with them. And towards the end of Shabbat, towards like Sudash Lishit time, so we decided before Sudash Lishit, we'd go for a walk. And I took them, they were staying in the south of Jerusalem, out in that direction. And there's a beautiful, beautiful overlook in a place called Herodion. Herodion is a winter palace of Herod, it's a little less known than Masada. It's magnificent, it looks out on the Judean desert. And I figured I would take them out there, and it'd be great. And as I'm walking, and I had like a book, a couple of books, I was going to read them a reading. And as I'm walking underneath, I see I'm walking underneath the Eruv. I'm walking underneath the wire, so I couldn't carry. So, there was a bus stop there. So I took my books and I put them in the bus stop. I figured when I get back, I'll come back. I'll see them. You can do that in Jerusalem, right? You can put your books in the bus stop. They'll be there when you get back. Can't do this in New York. You try this in New York. I tried this in New York. I took a Talmudic tractate called Menachos, which is like this obscure section of Talmud that deals with sacrifices. It had my name and my number and everything in it. And I went into a cleaner's and I had too many things. So I put it down in the bus stop outside the cleaner's. Came out 2 minutes later, it was gone. What anybody in New York needs with my Gemara Menachos, I have no idea. But someone out there is trying to figure out sacrifices. Anyway, so I put these down, right? And I'm walking out, I don't think about it. 2 seconds later, one of these kids comes over to me and goes, Oi! Which means, excuse me, in their version of English, right? Oi! You forgot your books, Mom! Right? Now, what do I say to this guy? Oh, no, I didn't forget my books. Actually, we just walked under a wire. We're now in a public domain. So what does that mean? What is that? Okay. So we got to figure out what carrying is. And we got to figure out what this whole concept of back and forth is. I'm going to go 5 minutes over with your permission because I don't want to leave you hanging. Is that okay? What do you know about this watch? What do you know about this watch? What do you know about the difference between this watch and here? This is a good one. Take you a minute. Turn around. And this watch. What's the difference between this watch and this watch? Pardon? What's the most major difference between this watch and this watch? This is mine. You look at this watch and you assume it's mine. See, when I carry something, it's mine. I demonstrate control. And one day a week you remember you're not in control.
That's the idea of carrying. As a matter of fact, there's a transaction, a kinyan. You know, if I want to buy something, and I'm talking to Steve, and I say, Steve, I'd like to buy your glasses. I don't know why, I just feel like buying your glasses. So he says, okay, great, I'll sell you my glasses. And I say, great, I'm going to buy it, that's it. Are the glasses mine? Yeah. Nope, not mine yet. We haven't done anything to finalize the deal. Now, if I give him some money, and he accepts that money, then the glasses are mine, even if they're still in his possession. What if I don't have any money? So, well, I could say to him, you know what, I'll give you this as a collateral, my pen. Right? And, you know, I don't imagine Steve is dumb enough to give me those glasses for this pen, but let's say, right? So, I give him the pen, he accepts the pen, it's mine. That's a different kind of transaction. One is a money transaction, kinyan kesef, and one is a barter transaction, kinyan chalipin. Let's say I don't have anything to give him. So we do what's called a kinyan meshicha. Limshoch is to pull, is to grab. Right? So, by taking this pair of glasses and picking it up, I demonstrate control on an object. And by demonstrating control, and by his viewing that and accepting that as the conclusion of a transaction, so we've agreed that these glasses are going to be mine. And by the way, I don't have to lift up the glasses. I can lift up his pen. And I can say, I'm demonstrating by controlling this object that I wish now to control the glasses. He agrees they're mine. That's why, by the way, if you ever go to a traditional Jewish wedding and you catch the signing ceremony of the marriage license beforehand, so the groom undertakes certain obligations to the bride. And he does a very strange thing. The rabbi gives him a handkerchief or a talis, that's what I use, or a pen, and he says to the groom, okay, do you agree to undertake all of the conditions here? You know, to, God forbid, in the event that you get divorced, to pay certain amounts of money, and if you're doing a prenuptial agreement, which is what I do, so then in the event that you don't agree through a Jewish court of law to a divorce, so then you have to pay a certain amount of money a day, and you have certain responsibilities to provide for her and to care for her and everything else. And he says, yeah, and he signs his name. And what do? Before he signs his name, he picks something up and he puts it, and you know, you say, okay, I want you to lift up the, okay, lift it up in the air, lift it up in the air, right? Say, okay. Now it's a big problem because a lot of rabbis don't explain to the groom exactly what he's doing. So he's just like, you know, okay, I want you to lift the pen up there, lift up the pen in the air. Great. So he lifts up the pen in the air. Okay, now flap your birds, right? I mean, you know. But what you're really doing is you're demonstrating that you, by taking control of this object, understand that you are taking responsibility for this contract. So when I take control of something, I'm demonstrating that it's mine. When I carry, what I'm effectively saying, right, is that I wish to be in control of this object. One day a week you remember you're not really in control. You know, there's a magnificent medrash. Magnificent. And the medrash says that there were two people who came to a rabbi. You read this medrash, even though it was like, you know, some 1,500 years before Chassidut ever was thought of, right? But it seems like the guy is almost a Hasidic Rebbe, right? And there's a famous case in the Gemara, it's in Bava Metzia, it doesn't matter, the tractate. And two individuals are arguing about land. And each one says, Zeomer Shalavotai, Vazeomer Shalavotai, each one says, this land is my forefathers, right? The land was passed down to me. I may not have a contract, and I may not be able to prove it, but it's mine. So they both come to the rabbi, and they say, this land belongs to me. So the Rebbe in the Midrash looks at them and says, well, I can't help you. I mean, I'm listening to your claim. And I'm listening to your claim. And I don't know whose it is. Let's ask the land. Now, the Midrash doesn't say this, but I imagine these two litigants standing before this Rebbe are thinking to myself, okay, we came to the wrong guy, right? And the Medrash literally has this Rebbe bend over and cup his ear to the ground. And you can picture them thinking like, yeah, okay, cuckoo for cocoa bus day, thank you very much. But okay, right? And he straightens up and he says to them, you know what the land says? The land says it's not yours. And it's not yours. You're its. Ki me'afar ata ve'afar tashuv. Because God created you of the dust, and to the dust you will return. In other words, one day a week you remember that nothing you have is really yours. That you're temporarily here, and it's given to you as a gift. And it has a purpose. And the challenge is what you do with it. And the surest way not to do with it, what you can do with it, is to forget why it was given to you. And so one day a week you remember why it was given to you. And that's why you don't carry. So what about an Erev? So what's this whole wire thing? So I'll tell you a quick story which will illustrate the point. Okay? And you agree with me, this Erev, I mean, it sounds ridiculous.
So I'm going to tell you something even more ridiculous. And by telling you something even more ridiculous, maybe we haven't figured out this ridiculous thing. So I was once on a mitzvah mission, right? There was a family in Israel, they were in desperate straits, and they needed money, a long story. And I succeeded in raising some money, and someone else also helped me, and there was $1,200 in cash, and it was up near Washington Heights, and I was going to take this money, you remember this story. And I was going to take this money, every time I think of this story, I just laugh at what an idiot I was, right? So, okay, so I was going to take this money, and go with it to Israel. And I didn't manage to get up there, and it was Friday afternoon, and I was flying out Saturday night, so I knew I had to get up there. I had a rented car. I'd been on a trip. So I drove up from the west side. I was on the west side of New York City for Shabbat, and I was driving up to the Washington Heights, about 100 blocks away, 5 miles, and I was going to go get this money and bring it back home, and then Saturday night, I'll take it with me. I'll give this family. Okay. So I got up to Washington Heights, and you know, first you have to find a parking space, and then you have to be sure that your car is going to be there when you get back to the parking space, and wherever else it is, you have to find the address, and nobody there speaks English, and whatever else it might be. So I finally find the right place, and this is in not exactly the most pleasant of neighborhoods, and I manage to get the money, and I'm a little nervous about it, and I'm carrying $1,200 cash in my pocket, you know, through Spanish Harlem, and I get into my car, and I start driving. And I get onto the West Side Highway, and I was an idiot, because I should have gone earlier, but I didn't get to it, and the sun is coming close to setting, and it's Friday afternoon. Anyway, I suddenly realize I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to make it before the onset of Shabbat. Not even with the extra 18 minutes you get until the sun actually sets. There's no way I'm going to make it. I get stuck in this mother of all traffic jams. It's like God is saying to me, you know, you should have gone early in the morning. Don't mess with my Shabbat. Okay, so I don't know what I'm going to do. So I'm thinking this through, and I realize, okay, there's nothing else I can do. I got to walk. I'm not going to drive on Shabbat, right? I had never driven on Shabbat except for the army, and I wasn't going to do it now. So I feel, okay, I have to walk. Now, walking through Spanish Harlem, into Harlem, on 155th, 158th Street, is not a bright idea. It's just, you know, not recommended, especially with the kippah and tzitzis and whatever else it is. But okay. So now, I have one dilemma. Now, the car's a rental car, so I don't mind leaving it there, and I'll call up the rental car company Saturday night, and I'll tell them my problem. I was already thinking how I would tell them. Well, I left the car there because it was my Sabbath. Ha, great. Right? You're insured? Sure. But okay. And I had no luggage with me, because I was just going up to Washington Heights. But what did I have? I had my wallet. With $1,200 in it. Now, you can't carry money on Shabbat. What am I going to do with it? So I'm not going to go put it under some rock somewhere. First of all, because I don't have the time to go find it Saturday night. And second of all, because I might as well hang a sign that says, please steal me. I mean, you know, this is not the best of neighborhoods. So there's a little known halacha, which is a brilliant halacha. It's called the halacha of shinui. Shinui means that I do something in a different way, l'shanot, to change it. But it really, the understanding of it is, if I do something so ridiculously, it sort of drops it down a level. If something is biblically prohibited, and I do it in such a weird fashion, there's only a rabbinic prohibition against it. Like, for example, you're not allowed to eat a cheeseburger, biblically. But if I'm flying through the air, and people are playing cheeseburger catch, and I'm flying through the air, and as I fly through the air, I grab one and eat one, and I grab one and eat one, so that's such a weird way of eating, it may well be that that's not biblically prohibited. The Torah wasn't going to waste the time saying, don't fly through the air playing cheeseburger catch. But it's still rabbinically prohibited. Okay. So anytime, so sometimes you have a problem, and you want to solve the problem, and the prohibition isn't a biblical prohibition, because if it's a biblical prohibition, all you can do by using this loophole is make it rabbinic, but you still can't do it because it's a rabbinic prohibition. But if there's something which is a rabbinic prohibition, so it could be in certain instances that you can make it permitted, or you can do it in certain severe circumstances. Okay. And sometimes you can even take a biblical prohibition, whatever. So I remember, for example, once my mother was very ill, and I don't know if her life was in danger, because if her life was in danger, then I could do anything. You know, I could light a fire. But, you know, she was really not well, and she had a fever, and she had a headache, whatever. So she was in a room, and I wanted to turn the light off for her. So I didn't want to just turn the light off, because, you know, I wasn't sure 100% whether I should do it or whatever. So what did I do, right? I turned it off with my nose. I went to the light switch. So you could picture, like, somebody comes over to see the beauty of Shabbos, and they come in, and there's Rabbi Friedman turning off the light switch. Oh, I'll be right with you. I'm just doing something weird so that it's okay. Oh, right? So this is like, you know, people normally do this sort of thing. So if you find that you're in a situation, and it's this wasn't a public domain biblically, it was a public domain rabbinically, so b'shat atchak in certain dire circumstances, you know, $1,200 for tzedaka, very important, whatever. So if you carry it in some weird fashion, right? So even though really you shouldn't be doing it, you're allowed to do it, right? So now I'm thinking now, the Talmud gives all sorts of examples, you know, carry it under your arm, or put it on your head, or carry it in your mouth. Something, yeah, that's a bright thing to do. Walk through Spanish Harlem with a wallet in your mouth. Please steal me, then kill me and beat me, right? Not a good idea. Anyway, I finally figured out I took the wallet, and I sort of put it in the back of my neck, and I stuck it half out, because I figured if anybody saw me and saw something sticking out of the bottom of my neck, they would never imagine that some Jew is walking through Spanish Harlem with a wallet sticking out of the bottom of his neck, so they'd leave me alone, right? And I made it. Rabbi Riskin, and later I once related this to Rav Lichtenstein, they both told me I was crazy and I should have kept driving. But okay, because they said that my life was in danger. But all right, right? Anyway, so I was probably wrong for the whole story. But okay, right? Now, what's the whole point here? So how come a shinui works? What does it mean? Because if the whole idea is that I'm supposed to remember that there's something above me, that there's a higher purpose, that it's not just me who makes the rules, that it's not just me, that it's to serve a higher ideal. If I'm supposed to remember that all of this is given to me and I'm not really fully in control of it, then if the only way that I can carry something is to put it in the back of my neck, if the only way I can turn on a light switch is to do it with my nose, so somehow I still remember I'm not really in control. I don't think I'm in control if the only way I can do it is with my nose. So if the only way I can carry is to carry inside an Eruv, inside a wire, I mean, nobody would shower behind a wire. Nobody really thinks that's a private domain in the physical sense. The rabbis almost seem to choose a symbol which is absurd, which you would never imagine to be a private domain, because that wire serves as a reminder that you are not really in control. And that's the essential idea of Shabbat. One day a week you have an opportunity to remember that there is a higher ideal, that there is a relationship you can develop, that there's a majesty to all that you do. And you sit on Shabbat and you look back at your week and you see all that you've done. And there's so much that you've done. But all that you've done is not complete until you take a day to process it and to consider what the purpose of it all is and why you've done it all and what its meaning is and where its direction is and what you want to do with what you've done. So that's part one of an idea of an understanding of Shabbat.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.